Yeah, this has been a long time. I wouldn't say planning, but been thinking about it for a long time since, as Henry said, since we first thought of bringing Baraka here. Because each of us talking about Baraka coming had our own encounters, our own early, in many cases formative encounters with Baraka's work. For some people it was the Dutchman, for other people it was Blues People or poems from the first couple books. And then, of course, people had maybe re-encounters, sort of along the way. But a sense of the whole from Leroy Jones through the Baraka phase didn't seem to have that, right? We seemed to need some sense of the whole. And then I was out in San Francisco visiting my friend there in April, and I came across this book that claims, right, the Miri Baraka reader to do that, to kind of create this span and sort of breaks his life into these periods and these mini essays sort of connecting the bits. Baraka himself commenting on his different phases and changes. So it's like, okay, here's the text, right? Here's the perfect text to sort of start with. So that's sort of the anchor for the evening is the Miri Baraka reader. But then I'll be kind of pulling in some other texts here and there. When I get to the phase on music, Willie's going to read a couple poems at that point before we switch from his bohemian, downtown, new American poetry period to his commitment to the Black Arts Movement and Black nationalism. That's Willie's going to come in the in-between part there. And then there'll be a transition from the Black Arts and Black nationalist commitments to a more international, socialist, anti-imperialist worldview, which is his next pivot. And then in that section, then Henry will come in with some of what he's written about Olson and Sun Ra, which apparently will be the matter he'll deal with in a week or so.
As well as his, how Olson influenced him as
yeah,
a poet.
As well as his own,
Yeah.
his own encounter with Olson. Cool. Yeah, and that Olson Sun Ra thing is, I don't know if you guys remember when Michael Peters came here or either a couple of readings, but that's one of his big projects is Olson and Sun Ra. So that's been something. I'm really excited to hear what Baraka's take on that
and
connection.
It was also a big part of Andre Spears, who's on our
really?
Board.
Yeah,
it was
of
part
course.
Of his dissertation.
Sun Ra
and
Olson.
Yeah.
That's cool. Is Andre going to be here
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Has he talked to Michael? Do you know?
I don't think.
Okay. Well, we'll make that happen then.
Yeah.
Right? All right. So, to jump in to this. So loosely, the time periods are the sort of bohemian downtown beat period. Downtown being New York City, 1957 to 1962. Then there's a transition. 63 to 65, that's where the Dutchman appears in the second book of poetry. The Dead Lecturer appears in this transition phase. Then his engagement with Black nationalism is in the switch from Jones to Baraka, 1965 to 1974. And then from 74 on is the sort of anti-imperialist socialism, or what sometimes gets called third world Marxism. So it would be 74 on. So that's loosely the breakdown. One of the things I noticed sort of in the early period, though, and I think I gave as the subtitle the sort of a quote from Bruck in which he talks about how it's really all part of the same work. And that's one of the things that really struck me is despite these periods, I see this struggle in the early poems even, which he sort of wants to reject as having this white bohemian sort of inflection to them, or that sort of commitment, not as political as he wanted to be. Although he later says that about them, you still still see in them the struggle with the interrelationship within him of being black, but within late Western civilization, late manifestations of the imperialism of Western civ. Even in these early poems, you see this America, when he talks about America, that word is often linked in I think really politically charged way to words like loveless, dry, dead, vapid, a carcass. These sorts of things come up. And also another thread, and that of course runs through the whole of his work, and a way to find a life force within that. And you can see why he might be interested in something like Olson's projective verse, right? He wants to inject and project life into this dead thing, right? And there are a lot of similarities in the sort of language between Olson and Baraka of that period. There's also a sexual tension that it manifests, that there's when he's talking about something that's dead and dry and loveless, there's often like the desire for a sexual charge in that, which he turns towards, it turns against. You know, there's a kind of open sexuality of the downtown bohemian age that he's very, you know, skeptical of, you know, sort of white bohemian sexual openness in the Dutchman, right? Like you really see it portrayed there. I see some really terrible online versions. I don't know if anybody else has checked these out of the Dutchman, where the white woman is very naive and unknowing. And of course she is naive in some ways, right, in his portrayal, but one of the whole points is how the male figure, the particular projection of Baraka there, is really more naive and grows mistrustful of the white woman's cynicism towards the world. Like so they agree on a kind of critique, right? This is actually where the sexual charge between them comes from, is this sort of the cynicism and critique. But as the play goes on, you know, he starts to the male figure starts to realize that they don't actually share ground, right? They don't have a common ground for this cynicism, right? And as he turns against her, you know, she ends up stabbing him at the end. And I think that has a lot to do with this dead, this envisioning of America as not only dead itself, but as killing, right? But in these poems, these earlier works, there does seem to be some like hope for life force in this white bohemian, you know, largely white bohemian culture, that then by the time 64 comes and he's doing the Dutchman, you know, that he's now mistrustful of. So, one of the paradox about Baraka is that, you know, his most famous poem is such a sweet poem, not without the sort of the anger that most of his poems known for. And I think prefaced to a 20-volume suicide note, it's just one of the absolute most sweetest poems that I know. And I think about, you know, with my children, so I want to start there in a paradoxical way. Prefaced to a 20-volume suicide note for Kelly Jones, born 16 May 1959. Lately, I've become accustomed to the way the ground opens up and envelops me each time I go out to walk the dog, or the broad-edged, silly music the wind makes when I run for a bus. Things have come to that. And now, each night, I count the stars, and each night I get the same number. And when they will not come to be counted, I count the holes they leave. Nobody sings anymore. And then last night, I tiptoed up to my daughter's room and heard her talking to someone. And when I opened the door, there was no one there. Only she on her knees, peeking into her own clasped hands. So, well, I don't want to comment too. Let's let the poem speak for itself. So the sweetness there, I think, really contrasts with poem from the same book, like Hymn for Lainey Poo, which in section 7 has these lines. It is because of this similarity of interests that they will probably get married, smiling and glad, in the huge and loveless white Anglo son of a benevolent stepmother America. Or from Notes for a Speech. And here you really feel like he would like to participate in like a sort of back to Africa idea, but really, you know, he's American, right? So you hear it here, where he says, "Africa is a foreign place. You are as any other sad man here, America. Africa is a foreign place. You are as any other sad man here, America." So it's like neither place, right? There's not an option. Like, this is no good. That's not for me either. And you can see, like, the seeds, like the sense of it's one whole work of what will then become the black nationalism. It's like just a couple years away. So my in was Blues People. That was the book. You know, I'd read the poems, but my first, like, this isn't, you know, really my changing experience with Baraka, and he was then Jones, was, and I think I picked it up at the Salvation Army on Main Street, is where I also got The Dead Lecturer there. I don't know whose books they were, who would have had these books in town and got rid of them there, but so he says, this critique of America is loveless, dry, dead, vapid, a carcass, continues in his musical criticism. So he says, he talks about, in music criticism, he had this little like side note on poetry. Accentual verse, the regular metric of rumbling iambics, is dry as slivers of sand. Like, Olson could have written that, right? Or, you know, whatever, right? I mean, it's like, if you think about projective verse, like, in the critique there, of course, accentual verse, the regular metric of rumbling iambics, is dry as slivers of sand. But what's not Olson, but what's Jones here, becoming Baraka, is this, the dryness, the lack of life in it, right, that he keeps coming back to. It did not occur to them, meaning the white musicologists, the Africans might have looked askance at a music as vapid rhythmically as the West's. Like a vapid, right? Like this dryness, this emptiness. And then he quotes this guy, Ernest Borgnine, in Blues People. I think this is from Blues People too, saying, it's really telling, I think, about his own language at the time. So we get, in language... So again, he's writing about music, but I was interested in these times where he would link up sort of what's happening in his own poetry, I think, and why he's writing about music. So while in the midst of this, talking about the blues tradition, he says, in language, the African tradition aims at circumlocution rather than exact definition. So later, when he was putting together the Dante book, the system of Dante's Hell, he would critique his own work as obscure and say that it was obscure because he was writing defensively. But back before the pivot, he was claiming that this circumlocution, this obscurity, was actually part of an African tradition. Right? In language, the African tradition aims at circumlocution rather than exact definition. The direct statement is considered crude, unimaginative. The veiling of all contents in ever-changing paraphrases is considered the criterion of intelligence and personality. Again, it seems like why he would be drawn to the New American Poetry. And in music, the same tendency towards obliquity and ellipsis is noticeable. So he gets back into the music part. But this digression is interesting, as it made perhaps a kind of justification for why he's... using language that he would later call obscure, but that's suggestive, that is twisting on itself, as opposed to, more politically engaged, clear statement, right, that he would later come to see as more necessary, and he would critique this time. So I'm going to read a couple passages on from the music stuff, and then I'll hand things over. So here's some of his other two other passages on music. Blues, as an autonomous music, had been in a sense inviolable. There was no clear way into it, i.e., its production, not its appreciation, except as concomitant with what seems to me to be the peculiar social, cultural, and emotional experience of a black man in America. The idea of a white blues singer seems an even more violent contradiction of terms than the idea of a middle-class blues singer. So what's really under the surface here is that Jones is middle-class. Right, it's a middle-class black man, right? And so he's wrestling. So this is another thread that I found, was the wrestling over race and class. Because even when he went from downtown, uptown, in the black arts phase, he still felt that he was an outsider who had to prove himself because he wasn't from Harlem. He wasn't of that milieu. And you could see it already creeping in here. But notice the academic prose, too, right? You could hear that. I wanted to... He wouldn't write like that again. that was going to go, too, that kind of way of writing. And then one last phrase. And again, the language, I think, what he's saying is really important, but how he's saying it, that would also kind of undergo evolution. As I have said, jazz had a broadness of emotional meaning that allowed of many separate ways into it, not all of them dependent on the, quote, blood ritual of blues. The real point of this cultural breakdown, and when he's using the term breakdown to talk about how white artists were able to actually take jazz and actually create with it, add new voices to it the way they white musicians couldn't do with blues, is what he's trying to get at here. The real point of this breakdown was that it reflected not so much the white American's increased understanding of the Negro, but rather the fact that the Negro had created a music that offered such a profound reflection of America that it could attract white Americans to want to play it or listen to it for exactly that reason. So this was, you know, the idea that creating an art form that was a profound reflection of America, it was something, again, that comes up in his musical criticism over and over again. And that it's not, it's such a rich form that, of course, it has to do with the black experience, and the black experience necessarily leads to it. But it doesn't. But here there's the possibility, and he names of white innovators who could take the music, of course, in a different direction than the black artists were doing. But that the African American tradition had created this richness to it that could lead to kind of more proliferation, right, in a lot of different directions. It's kind of an interesting idea, because that possibility would close down shortly in the black nationalist period, right? Like that wouldn't be of interest to him in the way that it was earlier.
And it also led towards really the beginnings of integration, right? Because all these artists, these white artists, were going to hear these and was breaking down those barriers in clubs and so forth.
Absolutely.
So they were kind of like the ambassadors back then, even in the 30s and 40s and definitely in the 50s when Barack was talking about that stuff.
Herb Pomeroy, Amanda, my wife, I don't know if I know everybody in the room, everybody knows Amanda, she interviewed Herb back when we were in college at Emerson, and he talked about the kind of the blur of the lines between the segregation, playing segregated gigs and unsegregated gigs, and that Herb sometimes gets sent in for food when he's with black musicians. He'd be the one, okay, you'd have to go in. And that whole crux of the turn, right? Some places it was cool, some places it wasn't, and you had to kind of walk that line. I think it's a really charged and important thing.
James, Herb was the only white musician on the Lionel Hampton thing.
Exactly, right, yeah.
Amazing.
Some of the stories were from that trip, traveling around. And
it's extraordinary.
I hope I should get Amanda to dig those up. The interviews are really great that she has, and speaks a lot to his white experience of the kind of thing you're talking about. But I'm gonna yield the floor to Willie's gonna read us some poems, and then we'll pick up the thread.
Here's the preface, my 1963 copy from probably the Grolier bookstore in Harvard Square. Old beatnik stuff here. Okay. In memory of radio, who has ever stopped to think of the divinity of Lamont Cranston? Only Jack Kerouac that I know of, and me. The rest of you probably had on WCBS and Kate Smith, or something equally unattractive. What can I say? It is better to have loved and lost. Is it better? Oh, it is better to have loved and lost than to put linoleum on your living rooms. Am I a sage or something? Mandrake's hypnotic gesture of the week. Remember, I do not have the healing powers of Oral Roberts. I cannot, like Fulton J. Sheen, tell you how to get saved and rich. I cannot even order you to the gas chamber Satori like Hitler or Goody Knight. And love is an evil word. Turn it backwards. See what I mean? An evil word. And besides, who understands it? I certainly wouldn't want to, I certainly wouldn't like to go out on that kind of limb. Saturday mornings we listen to the Red Lantern and his undersea folk. At 11, let's pretend. And we did. And I, the poet, still do. Thank God. What was it he used to say after the transformation when he was safe and invisible and the unbelievers couldn't throw stones? Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of man? The shadow knows. Oh, yes, he does. Oh, yes, he does. An evil word it is, this love. Yeah. Here's that mild stuff. Here's one for Henry. It's called Prez Spoke in a Language. Prez spoke in a language of his own. What did he say between the horn lines, pork pie, hat, tenor tilted? Prez once was a drummer, but gave it up because other dudes was getting the foxes while he packed his tom-toms. Ding dong, Prez said, meaning like a typewriter, it's the end of this line. No eyes, Prez would say, meaning I couldn't dig it, and what it was lame. Prez had a language and a life like all his own. But in the teeming whole of us he lived, tooting on his sideways horn, translating Frankie Trumbauer into bird's feathers, trained sinewy tracks, the slickster walking through the crowd, surviving on a terrifying wit. It's the jungle, the jungle, the jungle we're living in. And cats like Prez could make it because they were clear. They at least had to do anything. They at least had to do anything else. Save all that, comrades. We need it. This one's called Epistrophe. It's a monk song. It's such a static reference looking out the window all the time. The eye's limits. On good days, the sun. And what you see here in New York, walls and buildings, or in the hidden gardens of opulent Queens, profusion, endless stretches of leisure, or leisure. It's like being chained to some dead actress, and she keeps trying to tell you something horribly maudlin, like the leaves are flat and motionless. What I know of the mind seems to end here, just outside my face. I wish some weird-looking animal would come along. There he is. That's it.
That's great. That was perfect. It worked out perfectly, because that's like the... Now we're going to turn away from all that. We're basically in an interesting way. But not exactly. Because things keep coming up.
You call that op-ed?
Huh? Or you just realize, I don't know. All right, so you get going over this material, what I noticed in 1964 in the second book of poetry published, The Dead Lecturer, an intensification of the inner struggle with the relationship between African American culture and that inheritance of the anger and the insight into America, and some of the maybe less there's still playful moments, but maybe more anger. Right? Those poems are so playful. The turns, right, are so the wit, so on. But also a struggle now, becoming more overt, a struggle with the critique of Bohemian open white culture, right, which he had at one point kind of turned to, but you know, this is sort of failing him. And so in 1978, in an interview, he said, well, first of all, in terms of form, it tended at times to be obscure. He's talking specifically about the system of Dante's Hell, but later he lumps in The Dead Lecturer with this too. Tended to be obscure. The reason for that is that I was really writing defensively. I was trying to get away from the influence of people like Creeley and Olson. I was living in New York then, and the whole Creeley Olson influence was beginning to beat me up. I was in a very closed little circle. And then, okay. So that,
you know. He doesn't mention Dorn there.
No, yeah. He leaves Dorn out of it at that point. Dorn's alive, so, right, the Creeley's alive too at that point, but he's willing to. I'll say more about that later. So this intensification of the struggle comes out in things like, I am inside someone who hates me. I look out from his eyes. I'm inside someone who hates me. I look out from his eyes. And then this little bit is from a later poem, but it's him looking back at this period. When they say it is Roy who is dead, I wonder who they will mean. And he talks in another line from that poem called The Liar. This line was publicly redefining each change in my soul. And it feels like he's doing, you know, public, these poems, these writings, he's in public doing this. All of these changes in associations, allegiances, publicly redefining each change in my soul. So this is when the Dutchman comes and kind of celebrity, right? I mean, he wins the Obie for this play, and it's not till like 67 that the film is made, but still. And I just wanted to read a few lines to catch the flavor of this. And this is really a turn. I read it as a turn against the Bohemian scene and his former self, that happens just over the course of this play. Because you're talking about like parties and things, so they're talking about a Bohemian party here, and you got Lula says the atmosphere will be slithering in love and half love and very open moral decision. Maybe we'll meet a Jewish Buddhist and flatten his conceits over some very pretentious coffee. And then Clay, the black character, answers, in honor of whose God? And then there's this, like, so they're playing back. You see, they're playing together there, right? There's like there's a critique that they're sharing. And there's this turn that happens, and the turn happens over music, right? Is the turn. The turn of the poem is about the blues, and I never noticed that before. It's like, I'm an idiot. I was like to myself, how come I didn't notice that before? But this is where the whole tone of the thing changes. Clay talks facetiously about idyllic plantation life. So they're playing along, and then Clay makes this joke about, oh yeah, you know how things were awesome back when we were living on the plantation, you know, basically what he says. And then he says, that's how the blues was born. Which then triggers in the white female character this really embarrassing, phantasmagorical, kind of blackface, singing, dancing, sex lingo display on you remember this? On the subway. And that's what, so he says this thing and then says that's how the blues was born, and then that triggers her sort of performance, and then he comes back, you know, everything's changed because of this performance, And Clay says, now you shut the hell up. Shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know anything, so just keep your mouth closed. Now shut up and let me talk. And that's the pivot, right? And that's when there's this long bit that a lot of people remember, really angry, long bit, sort of brilliant rant in there. So it's worth seeing again. I don't know. You know, and it's on YouTube. You can watch the film now. Six, I think it's 6 parts. I didn't. So anyway.
What's the title?
Oh, that's The Dutchman.
The Dutchman.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to point out, vis-a-vis Olsen and Baraka, and you know they were at that in Italy together with Pasolini.
Right. Yeah.
And,
oh yeah.
And there was a performance of The Dutchman.
Yeah.
And Pound. And Olsen and
yeah.
Baraka.
Yeah.
And I think I don't know, Garrett was there. Garrett's everywhere. But Wieners was there.
And Chuck Stein was there.
That's
Chuck
right.
came. Chuck was there. Yeah.
You weren't there though, Peter. Huh?
No.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That confluence of all of those characters happening,
yeah.
coming together.
That was in 1965.
63.
I think. Yeah. Yeah. I'm bad with dates, so I wouldn't say. So this is now when he's writing the system of Dante's Hell, which he later calls obscure and the writing defensively part. But you see this wrestling with the tradition that sort of gave him the forms that he was using as a poet. He writes in the section called The Heretics. He writes, and I turned away and doubled up like rubber or black figure sliding at the bottom of any ocean. Thomas, Joyce, Pound, all gone by. And I thought agony at how beautiful I was. And he's really critiquing himself. I thought agony at how beautiful I was and sat sad many times in latrines figuring my joint. But it was dusty and time sat where it could, covered me dead. So the association, right, of what cultures that are dead, covered me dead, like under a stone for years, and my life was already over, a dead man stretched, and a rock rolled over. A different section. So one thing's dying, right? It sounds like this self is dead. Two tremendous motherfuckers with stale white teeth grinned in back of the Jew and sat with baseball bats to protect the Western world. Baseball bats to protect the Western world. Anger coming. The dancing like a rite no one knew or had no use for outside their secret lives. He's seeking an integrated life here, right, as opposed to the secret lives. Anyway, it's really interesting that knowing more, to reread some of this stuff. But that image is of death, is rebirth. So the turn, he says, so when he's talking in that interview about Creeley and Olsen, and I was giving that up, he says, that was about the time I went to Cuba. I felt the need to break out of the type of form that I was using then. And he goes on to talk about how, to get the politics back in. So politics has just been kind of lying in there. He feels now the form hasn't been allowing it to come out in a more direct way. So he's seeking a form, a different form that's not as obscure or defensive and slippery, and to be more direct, and that's the turn to Cuba. So he wrote an essay, Cuba Libre, and he gets hammered. He's in Cuba, and he's getting attacked by all of these radical political folks who are accusing him of being bourgeois and all this. So he goes, you want to cultivate your soul? This is what Jaime Shelley, a Mexican poet, says to him. You want to cultivate your soul in that ugliness? In that ugliness you live in? You want to cultivate your soul? Well, we've got millions of starving people to feed, and that moves me enough to make poems out of. Another Mexican poet, a woman named Betancourt, she wasn't a poet, she was an economist, grad student studying economy. Betancourt said, called him a cowardly bourgeois individualist. Look, why you jump on me? This is how he responds. I understand what you're saying. I'm in complete agreement with you. I'm a poet. What can I do? I write, that's all. I'm not even interested in politics. Mm-hmm.
So, and this again, where he's turning. There's this great part where he actually meets and asks three questions of Fidel Castro, which is something I didn't know about. It's an interesting moment. I won't get into leave that aside for now. But now he publishes this book called Home, this collection of essays, Home, and begins with Cuba Libre, and then it by the end of the book it totally pivots. It basically takes it through the whole black nationalist phase, and by the end of it, looking back on that period, let me just take, I guess, through the black nationalist period first. So he's criticized for this apolitical stance, this leads to this turn, this trip to Cuba leads to this turn, and he writes things like The Legacy of Malcolm X and The Coming of the Black Nation would be an early thing in this period. What the black man must do now is look down at the ground upon which he stands and claim it as his own. It is not abstract. Look down. Pick up the earth or jab your fingernails into the concrete. It is real, and it is yours if you want it. But to want it as our own is the present direction. To want what we are and where we are, but rearranged by our own consciousness. So one thing I didn't understand before I did this research was how concrete, how not abstract his nationalism was. He really wanted, so in this essay, he actually calls for nationalization and assertion of sovereignty in cities with large concentrations of black people. It's like a physical turf thing, right? Which, you know, made me think of Olson, of course. Like, it is the particular, right? It's not an abstract nationalist identity. He has moments where he's theorizing about race, right? It's always dangerous, right? Theorizing about an essence for a race. But most of the time he's steering clear of that, and later he really hammers a critique at that, even for a black nationalism that theorizes an essence of race. He actually nails Leopold Senghor for that, you know, the negritude poet, but get to that in a minute. So he's actually, and also what I see here is the seeds. He's not making it explicit, but the seeds here, he's inspired to this nationalism actually by the national liberation movement. You know, it's like in 1961 where Khrushchev says that he'll support all wars of national liberation, right? This is at the time of a country, you know, Vietnam, Algeria, there's Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, right, all these countries like asserting their own overthrowing imperial colonial power. And that's the inspiration behind this, which I hadn't noticed also before, that that's the seed for the internationalism that's going to come, right, where he leaves behind the narrow, what he would, you know, critique as the narrowness and kind of muddy thinking he thought of his black nationalism. But then there are moments like this, right, which he would later critique. If we feel differently, we have different ideas. Race is feeling. So he says he's talking about black people. If we feel differently, we have different ideas. Race is feeling, where the body and the organs come in. Well, that blew my mind, because there's like Olson's interest in organs as the seat of being and the selves, which he radically extrapolates out of from Jung, but Baraka is talking about the organ, organs as the site of like racial feeling. Culture is the preservation of these feelings in super rational to rational form. Artism is our method of expressing these feelings and identifying the form as an emotional phenomenon. So that's the trick to get now what's the arts role, right? So he's in these essays, he's creating a role for the arts, and then that's where the Black Arts Movement, right? And so he writes the manifesto, 1965, Black Arts Movement manifesto. And then his writing about music turns at this point. And in one of these, I thought I'd share that he critiques, I was telling Willie about this on the drive over, he critiques Dylan and the Fugs and several other of the more radical sort of white musicians and politically charged musicians, of luxurious ego demonstration, abstract and luxury playing around. And Dylan particularly gets it for writing with idea and sentiment. And what's missing, you know, for him is this sort of this like more bodily felt political expression, right, that he's getting at in the, you know, the organs in the body, you know, and in the ground on you that you stand on, that you claim as your own, and all of that. But he felt that the white counterculture didn't have that, didn't have a ground. So, okay.
It was blowing in the wind.
Yeah, well, it's actually one of the things he critiques is that very song.
Masters of War.
Yeah. That doesn't come out in the particular essays that I read. I don't know if he, you know.
Who does he like?
He might like the anger of that, though, right? Master of War might have the bitter, some anger in it. Well, he talks about what was I telling you? Stevie Wonder covering Dylan, and how it's better. Like, Wonder gets it, right? It had body to it. It had some substance to it that he didn't feel was, he thought was idea and sentiment in Dylan's performances, right? I mean, he likes a lot of...
He's a better singer, come on.
Right, well, you know, and maybe, you know, who...
I wonder what he thought of Lenny Bruce.
I don't know. Didn't come across. Yeah.
Nina Simone, she was coming out publicly at that time.
Yeah. No, I mean, Lenny Bruce,
yeah, he writes,
they were contemporaries.
Nina Simone, yeah, definitely comes out.
Here.
Yeah. There's a lot, I mean, he likes a lot of, you know, he's, the music is really important. He even goes through, when he's writing about the Black Arts Movement, he in the memoirs about it, he goes through the soundtrack of the time, you know, what are the songs that were sort of they're playing and moving the whole thing. And there's a whole sound, there really is like this whole soundtrack to
talking
to
about James Brown.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he does this interesting mashup of Brown and Sun Ra, where one of his essays like breaks into this great poetry, you know, it becomes a poem. And it's like Sun Brown and James Ra. He does this, he actually mingles, but he makes them one being because he thinks there's something to that smash up, right? Yeah. Yeah, that was a really cool moment. I think,
Well, you know, in Lowell, the day before he comes to speak in Gloucester, that's what he's talking to music students at the University of Lowell. That's
oh, cool.
Wanted,
yeah.
That's what they wanted.
Yeah, it's always, it's interesting to track that. Like what he's saying about music is reflecting his political views and, you know, what he's thinking about poetry. You know, they're always kind of together like that. So in 1974, there's the turn, you know, at least by one way of marking it, there's a kind of the turn away from the black nationalism to something that gets called third world Marxism, or is a kind of just and it really an anti-imperialism, anti-capital stance that is more international in scope. He really insists on material conditions in this period as opposed to essences, because he realizes the problem of thinking of nationalism is thinking about essences, static essences, as opposed to lived material conditions. So, you know, as I said, there's this critique of Senghor as calling for, talking about a black essence, a static, he calls it a static cultural essence. And he opposes that to Aimé Césaire, who writes with a concrete consciousness to understand the world and change it. Right. And that's 1984 now, we're up to the 80s. Rumbling through time here, but he also talks about another African novelist who affirms African society. Who writes about the real world of suffering, and takes Africa kind of up to current conditions, as opposed to like Achebe, who affirms African society in the face of a rising colonial order, So that's an important story to tell, but not to stop there, to continue writing about the changing world of suffering, the changing material conditions on the ground is something he becomes interested in. And then there's, you know, if we want to sort of see how the anti-imperialist, anti-capital critique gets played out, you know, his most famous poem recently is the Somebody Blew Up America. And I just was going to read... Of course, you know, this is why there might be people a little bit worried about him coming and so on, right? I mean, this is a big deal, right? This is a national story. But you could really hear the the larger kind of picture he's painting here. You know, so one of the things he gets accused of is an anti, is that this gets criticized as an anti-Semitic poem. But he's anti-Israeli. He sees Israel as an imperialist nation, right? But this is a passage in the poem where he says he's kind of a litany of harms, wrongs done. Who put the Jews in the ovens? And who helped them do it? Who said America first and okayed the yellow stars? Who killed Rosa Luxemburg, Liebknecht? Who murdered the Rosenbergs and all the good people iced, tortured, assassinated, banished? Who got rich from Algeria, Libya, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Saudi, Kuwait, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine? Who cut off people's hands in the Congo? Who invented AIDS? Who put the germs in the Indians' blankets? Who thought up the Trail of Tears? Who blew up the Maine and started the Spanish-American War? Who got Sharon back in power? Who backed Batista, Hitler, Bilbao, Chiang Kai-shek? Who? And sort of goes on in this way, right? This vision of this larger anti-imperialist vision. And it's really, that's the dangerous thing, right, to people is anti-capital, anti-imperialism. There are other passages to read there, but...
when did he write that poem?
2001, October 2001, right after the Twin Towers fell.
Oh, right.
And that was his his way of responding,
yeah, right.
Was to sort of ask this question. It's like, okay, there's this event, but let's put this in the larger context of attacks on people in our times.
And he was poet laureate in New Jersey at the time, and the governor asked him to resign. The governor was getting all this pressure.
I don't know how I missed that one.
Yeah.
He wouldn't resign, so they abolished
the position
of poet laureate.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, Susan Sontag defended that poem.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. Yeah,
yeah. A lot of the New York Jewish intellectuals defended it,
right.
Because they didn't see it as an.
It's
attack.
Not anti-Semitic. It's anti-Zionist.
They saw it,
right,
as anti-imperialistic.
Right. Yeah. And it's so clear when you read the book. You read the poem. that point is clear. And you know the thing. Just in fairness, I mean there are some. You know there are conspiracy theories in the poem, right? I mean that are debunkable conspiracy theories, right? That he. No, but of course, to conflate the voice of the poem exactly with Baraka himself, too, is probably a mistake. This isn't an essay of a critique. This is a voice of asking questions about what is going on that we don't know about, what's beneath the surface of things. So, and I think another way to critique the poem is some of the conspiracy theories that are maybe wrong, right, that he brings up. But the point of it is to ask that he's not necessarily, he's in the poem, he's asking questions. Well, who did this? Not espousing one theory or another about, you know, Israelis, you know, being tipped off to the Trade Center, you know, that conspiracy, you know, familiar. That's in the poem, too. I didn't read that part, but that's another critique. And But it's the larger vision of it, I think, is important. That's what I wanted to bring up sort of today, is that it's part of this larger anti-imperial, anti-capital critique. And it's really relevant, you know, as Peter brought up some of the history. I mean, how many people remember? I'm sort of curious about how you remember that controversy in 2001. Who you remember?
Yeah.
Okay.
Israeli,
the poem, the controversy of the poem.
Yeah. I don't remember the poem.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that happened at that time.
I heard
so,
the part,
yeah,
about him being kicked out, but I didn't remember. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and it's definitely an issue with some people in town. You know, you bring up that Brock is coming to read. And,
yeah, there was the museum got pressure and asked James and I, we needed to go in and comfort them about Baraka, because they were concerned.
In fairness, I think that the museum, the people who were working were not. They just wanted to hear about why. You know, it wasn't sort of, can you justify this at all? You know, it wasn't that sort of thing at all. They were of the.
They were pressured by.
They were right, exactly, because you know, funding and such, right? I mean, right.
Well, they have a very conservative board, and I think what's really
which is so amazing that this is happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, absolutely.
About the staff.
Exactly, that's
about
what
the
yeah.
The director, the curator, the staff is that yep. the staff is really pushing innovation
right.
and transgressive art and transformative artists.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
And then their board is there. I mean, you know, in 1985, we had to fight with their board to have a Martin Hartley show.
Right.
Not only because they never had a modernist painter before, but because he was gay.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, obviously, I'm an outsider from the politics of Gloucester, but to me, it's all bullshit because he's black. You know, I mean, they can say, oh, he wrote this thing and we're nervous about bombs or whatever,
right.
but I think that the conservative board will be, it's the color of his skin still that I think makes the difference.
Peter, tell that high school story. About that guy who came to Gloucester who was told.
Oh,
you told
right.
me that story.
I was probably in junior high school.
Yeah.
And the school department was hiring teachers for the high school. And they hired a history teacher. And he had a very good background and good CV. They didn't even bring him in for an interview because he had such a good background. And when he arrived to teach, he was black. And they had, I mean, first of all, they never had a black person ever not only teach in the Gloucester school system, but enter the Gloucester school system. I mean, and of the city, Judy says. And what they did was, they gave him a year's severance and said, we made a mistake, we're sorry, we don't need you, and sent him away. Sitting on the school committee at the time was Harry Curtis, who was one of the founders of the John Birch Society. And at one point, when the Cape Ann Festival of the Arts wanted to bring the Duke Ellington Band to Gloucester, Harry Curtis didn't want the Duke Ellington Band to come to Gloucester because they were all black musicians. But of course, he didn't prevail in that one.
There was a move to query the superintendent about this, and Lewis, right, the labor organizer, who's also on whatever the committee was, he voted that they should investigate. He and one other person, David DeRich couldn't identify.
That's right.
David did the other person, like what the background was, but Lewis.
I'll tell you who it was. It was Paul Kenyon, who was the editor of the Gloucester
okay.
Times, and he was on the school committee. He was
okay.
the only liberal on the school
and
committee.
And they were going to investigate the superintendent.
They went,
but,
yes.
Right, but then that got voted down.
That's right.
The rest, you know,
and
they lost.
The story never got out.
Right.
The story never got out. It got around in Gloucester on the grapevine, but it never made the newspaper. It's a very significant telling story about Gloucester.
I got here in 83, and there was a guy, I lived in Rockport, and I had made a little thing out of a garage. And around the corner, once in a while, I would find a guy named Bobby Hebb, and I met him, and he lived in Rockport.
Baseball.
He was black. And he told me that he used to be the backup for the, I don't know, it was Frankie Lyman or some maybe. And his job was to pick up litter and garbage. I'd see him on 128 with a yellow bag, and he was always, you know, that was his
very good gig.
Happy to do his thing and to be who he was. But I kind of noticed it was very strange here.
James, let me ask a question. What period does the Black Dada Nihilismus poem come into?
I believe that's in the transitional.
Have you got
yeah,
it?
Let me,
would you read,
I do,
read,
yeah.
Read you,
sure.
Would you mind reading a little bit of it?
Sure.
I that was one of the most powerful poems came across.
It's in the Dead Lecturer, so okay. It's in that in 64, I think is when that was. So 71.
Black Dada Nihilismus.
Okay. Against what light is false what breath supped for deadness, murder the cleansed, purpose frail against God if they bring him bleeding, I would not forgive or even call him Black Dada Nihilismus. The Protestant love, wide windows, color blocked to Modrian,
and the ugly saint deaths of Jews under the surgeon's knife, to awake on 69th Street with money and a hip nose, black Dada nihilismus, for the umbrella Jesus, Trilby intrigue, movie house presidents, sticky the floor, BDN for the secret men, Hermes the blacker art. Thievery, ah, they return, those secret gold killers, inquisitors of the cocktail hour. Trismegistus, have them in their transmutation from stone to bleeding pearl, from lead to burning looting, dead Montezuma, find the west a gray hideous space. 2. From Sartre, a white man, it gave the last breath, and we beg him die before he is killed. Plastique, we do not have, only thin heroic blades, the razor, our flail against them. Why you carry knives? Or brutaled lumps of heart, why you stay where they can reach? Why you sit or stand or walk in this place, a window on a dark warehouse where the mines packed in straw, new homes, these towers for those lacking money or art, a cult of death, need of the simple striking arm under the street lamp, the cutters from under their rented earth. Come up, black Dada nihilismus, rape the white girls, rape their fathers, cut the mothers' throats. Black Dada nihilismus, choke my friends in their bedrooms with their drinks spilling and restless for tilting hips or dark liver, lips, sucking splinters from the master's thigh. Black scream and chant scream and dull unearthly, hollering Dada, bilious, what ugliness, learned in the dome, colored holy shit, I call them sinned or lost, burned masters of the lost, kneel German killers, all our learned art, remember what you said? Money. God, power, a moral code, so cruel it destroyed Byzantium, Tenochtitlan, Comanche. Got it, baby, for Tambu, Willie Bass, Du Bois, Patrice, Mantan, the bronze buckaroos, for Jack Johnson, asbestos, Tonto, buckwheat, Billie Holiday, for Tom Russ, Louverture, Vesey, Bo Jack. May a lost God, Dambala, rest or save us. Against the murders we intend, against his lost white children, black Dada nihilismus.
And what year is that?
So yeah, that book was published 64, I believe. Mm-hmm. Let me double check my dates here. Yeah, 64 was when The Dead Lecturer was published. Yeah. So yeah, that's really. So I was gonna.
I think you should look up online the Hustings.
Oh, okay, yeah. We can do that.
Because that was 64. Yeah. That was like right after Kennedy was elected.
Right.
Olson writes this letter to Baraka.
Yeah.
And I think it would really tie in Olson to the effect.
Do you want to do your thing, and I can look that up while you're doing your thing? And
yeah,
then I'll read the Hustings, and then we'll end with Baraka himself, recording of the wise thing. Okay? Cool.
Sure.
All right, so Henry's going to come up.
Right. So,
I'm going to read in 2009, after I had, I met Baraka, and he did this, I did an interview with him for the Olson film, and I knew that after that film was finished, I was going to be doing something on Prez, and the poem that Willie wrote, Baraka reads and will be read in the Lester Young film whenever I get it done. But he sent me this essay that he wrote in 2009. So when he told me that's what was going to be part of his lecture, I was knocked out. I'm going to read, I think I'm just going to read the Olson, it's 4 pages, it's probably about 10 or 15 minutes. I think I'll just read the first 2 pages, which is about Olson. And so it's called Charles Olson and Sun Ra, A Note on Being Out. If you cannot make the connection, you cannot understand the topology of the time in which they and some of us lived. Both are older than most of those they influenced. Olson was born in 1910, Worcester, Mass. Sun Ra in 1914, Birmingham, Alabama. Likewise, their careers were their lives and the changes they went through and influenced us to make. Olson began as an ascendant in the academic world, success until his PhD thesis on Melville, when, with the help of the Guggenheim, he dropped out. And with World War II, Assistant Chief of Foreign Language Division Office of War Information. From there into politics on the Democratic Committee, Democratic Party's National Committee, and chafing at the restriction and incompetence and bureaucracy drops out from there. His first book on extension and his PhD thesis, but much differently formed, Call Me Ishmael, The Brilliant Study of Herman Melville and Shakespeare in America. Later he became a rector of Black Mountain College, which was the nurturer both of Olson and the emerging American avant-garde in literature, painting, sculpture, dance, music, from 1948 until its closing in 1956. Olson didn't start writing a public poetry until he was 35, but even in the Ishmael, Olson throws out his challenging summary of who and where we are. I take space to be the central fact of man born in America from Folsom Cave to now. I spell it large because it comes large, large and without mercy. That idea he comes to again in poems, his grandly instructive essays, this essay projective verse, which first appeared in 1950, I published as a small pamphlet, Totem Press in 1959. In this essay, which I feel changed the direction of poetry in the U.S. for many young poets writing in the 50s and 60s, Olson urges the poet to stop using the closed forms of formal U.S. verse, particularly the dead, inherited detritus of English poetry. Yes. That a new American poetry must be built on the ear, the breath, the sound of the poet. It would be composition by field rather than overused, inherited, largely academic, usually iambic form. It would eschew form as a fixed object into which one poured a poem, thereby shearing away the spontaneous, quote, projective, percussive, prospective, poetic incident caused by heart, breath, sound, and syllable itself. In other words, the poem should not be contained in a box of dead preconsideration. The field was the open space of all life and memory. The poem should be open, and the experience of opening the heart to the mind. One perception must move instanter upon another. And from Creeley, form is never more an extension of content. One of these early Maximus poems begins, "It was he, the figure of outward. He was there." The figure of outward mentioned in some connection to Robert Creeley, who was in his own way out. And the poem Maximus projected from where the poet himself lived, Gloucester. A poem describing the place and the coming into of itself's self-creation, but also the going out, the observations of the poet, which included the nation, the world, and all the history, natural and human. The poem breaks down the restrictions of the literary closed verse, but even the form of its composition, reflecting newly the typewriter use in creating a score, as it were, to indicate just how the sound must be placed. Let me put it baldly, the head by way of the ear to the syllable, the heart by way of the breath to the line. And why Maximus of Tyre? He projected himself from that persona, a 4th century Greek philosopher of ethics. Taken thinly, it is a costume of sorts, but deeper, the projection of a particular way of seeing and thinking. Herman Sonny Blount, from Birmingham, Alabama, when at the height of his mystical summoning of space, time, the heavens, angels, and demons into the music, with such albums as The Magic City, we learn later was named after Birmingham. its actual official civil subrogant, so that Sun Ra, even the city of his birth, could be given other amazing qualities by the music he created and the persona he had thrust into the world. It is the parallels that tie Olsen and Ra together. They are both exert great influence over American art during the 50s until this day. Olsen died in 70, Ra in 93. In his preparatory development, Sun Ra, still Sonny Blunt, was an arranger and pianist with the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra, one of the cauldrons of the early swing that would, through the accretion of hipness, give rise to Duke Ellington's great orchestral classicism and Count Basie's nonpareil vehicle of swing. So that Henderson was actually the on-the-job creator of the big jazz orchestra, and it was here that Sun Ra received his on-the-job training, as they say in the service. So we can take this as the parallel to Olsen's academic pursuits. He's readying for his stretching out. By 51, Olsen writes Projective Verse. It's the same year that Sun Ra changes his name to Resonate, the ancient Egyptian sun god. That is, he is now moved away or forward from his schooling in Swing University, which name Phil Schaap of WKCR has revived at Lincoln Center, at least as a somewhat mobile institution, to become a force of his own creation. In the late 40s, Olsen had gone down to Black Mountain to become its last rector, and Sun Ra was going to Chicago to begin his manifestation as Ra. And when the first word of cosmic jazz began to be heard, albums like Sun Ra Visits Planet Earth, Interstellar Low Ways, Angels and Demons at Play, We Travel the Spaceways, confirms that it is more than a rumor that there is indeed a cosmic jazz. And that it is, holy Barack, emanating from Chicago, which has been the capital of Black America after the move north from the Black Belt and Atlanta. What's interesting is Ra's own projection is like Black mythology. He even called one of his orchestras Sun Ra and his myth, Science Orchestra. Olsen and his use of his home in Gloucester as a place to build a history and a mythology that in essence wanted to put the hinges back on the door so that we might go back and forth in a living history of space as well as time to begin to know ourselves and the place we are. I think that's such a great connection. Now, Ra would not don a costume, in fact, by the time I first saw him in the orchestra in the 60s. When they played, they were complete. Now Ra would don a costume when I saw him in the 60s. They were completely outfitted, as if from the vantage point from outer space. He could see the planet and its people and its problems from a higher viewpoint. If Olsen would speak from an ancient philosopher's persona, yet be rooted in the day-to-day livingness of Gloucester, Mass., an old fishing village which also fueled his, which had been fueled by his passion for Melville, as well as his terror and resolve to remove himself from the evil of the white whale, U.S. imperialism, whose pursuit and demented Ahab, and would destroy the ship named after the Native Americans Pequod and his multinational crew, in the midst of plenty, walk as close to bear. In the land of plenty, have nothing to do with it. Take the way of the lowest, including your legs. Go contrary. Go sing. Song 3 of Maximus. So that Olsen would remove himself to the isolation and poverty of Gloucester, where Sun Ra would remove himself from the planet itself. What makes these stances so magnetic is the context of the 60s itself, the whole period in which Mao summed up as revolution is the main trend in the world today. Some pundit of the Beats would describe this motion away from the mainstream as turn on, tune in, and drop out. In this case, there is a certain self-cultivation as well as self-anointment. But it was as close as the Beats would come to the truth of leaving the craven concerns of straight up America. So this is great in how this ties in totally, James, with everything.
That's the thread that's sort of what I found. You keep popping up. It's just a matter of what's in the foreground, what's in the background, what's emphasized now. You know, that's what changes, but the main threads, the main concerns, the main struggles and interests are there all the way through.
One of the most beautiful songs Sun Ra composed was We Travel the Spaceways from Planet to Planet. The music by this time was part of a whole pageant that Sun Ra presented. The members of his orchestra, like the Ark of the Knower, stepping, dancing, sometimes circling in their space costumes. Two of his greatest musicians, Marshall Allen, alto, and John Gilmore, tenor, and also our governor's father, Pat Patrick, at the forward end of the new music. Gilmore died a few months after Sun Ra. Allen is about to celebrate his 85th year and still a leader of the Avant. The names of Sun Ra's orchestras changed. Omniverse Orchestra, Solar Myth Orchestra, Outer Space Orchestra, Astro Infinity Orchestra, Blue Universe Orchestra, and so on. Some 30 names that I know. See Omniverse Sun Ra by Harmut Gürken and Bernden Hefele. Changing names is exciting, is one of Ra's quotes. To be another other. The cover of a new book of mine, Digging, which is right here. The Afro-American Soul of American Classical Music. There's a photo in front of the Black Arts Repertory Theater in 1965, which was located on 130th Street in Harlem. I'm at the bottom carrying a bag of refreshments, and at the top in the crowded staircase is Sun Ra. He came from the school many times and played for us on one of the four trucks we sent out every day with music, graphic arts, poetry, drama, to play in vacant lots, parks, play streets, and projects. We talked almost every day. On Wednesday nights, he would bring the orchestra and blow the place up. Ra was the first I had seen to use the synthesizer, which he called a space organ. Then he had the synthesizer with tubular lights on it that shined bright colors for high notes and dark colors for low notes. This is the first light show I witnessed. Sometime before, Bill Graham copped it in San Francisco and used it for rock shows. It was in this context that Ra taught me and others at the Arts, notably Steve Young, who was the administrative backbone of our endeavor, his cosmic philosophy. But for me, especially, his understanding of language. Larry Neal and I included Ra's poetry in the Black Arts anthology Black Fire, reprinted in 2008 by Black Classics Press, Baltimore. The poetry and prose collected in Immeasurable Equation. Ra taught a word is not only an idea, and this is so much a part of African American and jazz culture. It's not just an idea; it's a sound. It's a sound, and that sound has implied meaning. It's not just the meaning you get from a word. It has a force and power, and a way it sounded, Dig Olson, makes it open to the world of what it sounds like, and its many meanings manifest to once, and many meanings manifest at once to the digger. When we first arrived in Harlem, I carried the Black Arts flag designed by painter William White and the orchestra with Sun Ra, marching their cosmic strut down West 125th Street. There was a quote of mine given 10 years ago on the back cover of Sun Ra's book by John Swed, Space is the Place. Sun Ra's consistent statement, musically and unspoken, is that this is a primitive world. Its practices, beliefs, religions are uneducated, unenlightened, savage, destructive, already in the past. That's why Sun Ra returned only to say he left into the future, into space. Sun Ra's relentless admission that he really was from Saturn, i.e. not from here, and that he was an angel, though sometimes he would say that a people going along, say that if people going along with the corrupt Earth systems were considered good, then he was a demon. When a German reporter confronted Sun Ra a few years ago, saying, in effect, come on, Sun Ra, tell the truth, you haven't really been to Jupiter, Ra's answer was, no, but I've been to Saturn. Ra and Olson were perfect mentors for the advanced artists of the 60s and still at this moment. To give a list of those artists influenced by the two, e.g. by Olson, Robert Creeley, Ed Dorn, by Sun Ra, Gilmore, Marshall Allen, and many others, a great deal of the time by both. It would be a who's who of the great and important artists of the last part of the 20th century. We should go into that in detail in another note. Mary Baraka, May 2009, New York. So I don't know how much we'll have expand on this for this lecture or not, but I think it's cool to hear it before he.
You know something? I think that's probably the best explanation of Olson I've ever heard.
It's very concise.
Anyway, thank you for reading.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. I loved hearing, one of the things I skipped over in my notes was that he mentions here was sort of some of the day-to-day work of the black arts movement, right? And they did the theater, right? There's just so mostly what it was, I mean, there's the philosophy of it, which, you know, he turns against, but there was a real, like, day-to-day engagement with that community, right? Which wasn't, like, has a lot to do with his continued engagements now he's in Newark and Ra's, his sons, sort of political engagement, the relationship of the writing to, real in the community, on the ground, showing up at city council meetings kind of thing, which is something else, of course, he shares with Olson. There aren't a lot of poets who are of that stature that do that, and they both do. So, like, I like that he even managed to get that kind of what that life of that time was, what they were actually doing in the community, getting the music out, particularly, was what that was about. But there's so much of that kind of thing, and then really the end of it, for Baraka's in that period had as much to do with the interpersonal difficulties as it did with any kind of intellectual shift. Like the intellectual shift came out of actual interpersonal difficulties in realizing the limitations of those relationships that led to the switch to the anti-imperialist socialism, right? Mm-hmm. And he emphasizes that this has to be grounded in material conditions. When he mentions his there's no shedding particulars, sometimes Marxists want us to do. He's not going to go for that part of communism or Marxism. I think that makes that clear too. Right, as a thread. I found a page of it, but it ends in a nice place. So I'll read it. The Hustings, this is Olson's poem, and he actually explains what it's all about. The Hustings, a poem written to Leroy Jones 2 days after the election of John Fitzgerald Kennedy to the presidency of the United States. The future sucks all forward. The past has been removed. By progress, Cuba wishes to make its own sugar. The Soviet Union may have already contaminated the moon. China wants to destroy the United States, and Leroy Jones spits out the nation for its lies. I do too. I stay at home. I don't go beyond the West End of Main Street. I greet the cop on the beat in his top hat, Ben Smith, the roommate of the president. Joe at Tally's makes fun of my overshoes. The girl at the waiting station says the colors of my scarf and hat clash. I take them off. I say, so she can see me. I try to kiss my wife as she boards the bus, and she says, no, not in the street, and I go off. And that's where the poem cuts off in this version. And I go off.
And then he goes on to invite Leroy Jones to come to Gloucester.
Exactly. We've completed the promise offered in the poem, right? In the Hustings.
They didn't know each other? Did they know each other?
Well, oh, so he mentioned the other thing he mentions in there that I wanted to talk about mentioned was the Totem Press projective verse. Mm-hmm. That when I came to Gloucester, it was just on the Gloucester shelf at the library. I mean, it was just like in there. Right? And they said, I think you want to probably put this in active storage or something, right? It was that's how I read projective verse first, was in that. Not, you know, not any anthology or something, but on the shelf at the library here. And I think they do now have it in active storage. I mean, but they had a lot of really good things, like just jammed into the shelves back then, anyway. All right, so let's end with Baraka himself. So this is and Henry, what you mentioned about the sound of words, he actually talks about the turn to one of the things he wanted to. He talks about how the form was wrong for him, right? And some of what I read earlier from, you know, what he calls the Creeley Olson influence, that the form was wrong for his political commitments, and you know, so what he ends up kind of working towards, at least how he puts it, is a poetry that's more of an oral poetry, a poetry that's more to be read out loud, and where the real life of it, against the dead thing on the page, is the performance of it. So in what you're about to hear. There's a sax that comes in, but Baraka himself is doing the percussion during this. And you can really hear the sense of the meaning of the word being in the sound as much in that definition of the word. And I think this is a good, we'll end with Baraka himself. And this is a fairly recent performance of a poem that was written in the 80s, but a fairly written performance. And it's about... It's about three minutes long. Let me not trip over my cords. Sound up.
WISE. Africa. Africa, mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa, creator of the human being, of speech, of music, of the dance, ancient, mighty Africa, beautiful Africa. But when you put your hand on your sister, made her a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa, the ghost's gonna get you. When you put your hand on your brother, made him a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa. The ghost's gonna get you. Ah! How did I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? How did I get in the dark? How did I get here in the dark with the wind and water going for years? Watch out, Obatala, Shango, save me, Isa, save me. How did I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? My brother the king sold me to the ghosts. My brother the king sold me to the ghosts. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Black ivory. Black ivory. Wise one. If you ever find yourself somewhere lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your umbubaum, you're in trouble. They ban your boom ba boom. You in deep, deep trouble. Huh. probably take you several hundred years to get out. There's a railroad made of human bones, black ivory. Thank you. Rob Brown.